This week on BSD Now, you'll be getting the full jail treatment. We're going to show you how to create and deploy BSD jails, as well as chatting with Paul Henningkamp, the guy who actually invented them. So how cool is that? There's a lot of interesting news items to cover as well, so stay tuned to BSD Now, the place to be, SD. BSD Now, Episode 7, recorded October 16th, 2013. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Jude.
And we got a cool show coming at you today, a lot of good news, and a neat tutorial we're going to do here in a little bit. But first, let's get to the news. So the first headline we got this week, FreeBSD has officially turned it up to 11.
Yes.
I guess the current branch has been renamed as from 10 to 11.
And so FreeBSD 10-stable has actually been branched so that now basically development can continue on, you know, without breaking what's eventually going to become 10-release, although stuff can still be merged back in the normal fashion.
Mm-hmm. So they've already started rolling beta ISOs even. I mean, we're pretty far along at this point.
Yeah, I think the next beta ISO is Friday. I think so.
Yeah, I'm so far behind. I haven't even got our stable build done yet. Good Lord.
Okay. And then the release engineering branch should come the week after that, I think. And then the first release candidate after that.
Oh, man. Well, they are definitely pushing aggressively to get 10 out the door. And there's a lot of good features. There's going to be some churn, though. So if you guys can, any users out there want to start downloading and testing this, please do it now so we can start getting bug fixes in time for the release.
Yeah, the release schedule so far is actually stuck to the timeline pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has.
And if that continues, that would mean FreeBSD 10.0-release would come out November 24th.
Mm-hmm.
Which is more than a month ahead of the original schedule that everybody said was insanely optimistic.
Yeah. Man, I'm going to have to ask Glenn next week when we see him what exactly made him push so hard for this release to get out the door. Yep. But yeah, they're definitely pushing full steam on this one. Well, very cool. So what's next up in the news here, Alan?
The next one is a news article from Peter Hanstein about his research into stopping SSH brute force attacks using OpenBSD and PF. He's given a talk at BSDCon and... I think it was a tutorial at EuroBSDCon about these low-intensity botnets. Basically, they're attacking SSH, but doing it slowly enough that the it doesn't trigger the alarms. Like most things like fail to ban and so on will, you know, there's like so many login failures within this window of time. They just do it slowly enough that they don't trip over that. You know, it's like if the limit is 5 failed logins in half an hour, then only do 3 logins an hour.
Yeah.
While it takes a lot longer, if you use a lot of hosts and just spread it out, you can still brute force against that machine at the same rate, but without setting off the alarms and getting banned.
You got to hope, that in this case, that an admin's not watching their logs to see all the failed attempts. But yeah, that's a good way to sneak in. So what is his article about on how they've come up with some solutions?
Some of the lessons learned since he wrote the original talk for BSDCAN this spring. And it goes back to his first recorded evidence of this in 2007 and kind of walks through all the different things they've learned and trying to figure out what the business plan of the bad guys is and, you know, what doesn't work and what does and how to, you know, go forward from here.
Do we have a link? Is there a video or audio recording of
the BSDCAN talk? Yes. I'll add the link to the show notes.
Okay. Yeah, we'll put that in the notes.
It's not there.
That may be worth going back and watching if you're a security guy.
Or if you just have an SSH server somewhere.
Sure. Good to know. Okay. Well, next up, we got a ZFS and Jelly support in BSD install is coming soon.
Actually, that's included in FreeBSD 10 Beta 1 ISO.
Okay. So it's in there right now. So this is thanks to our own Alan Jude and the man with the beard, Teske, Devin Teske.
Who we saw on the show a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. So what does this do for you if you're unfamiliar with what Jelly is in FreeBSD, Alan?
So the main thing it does is normally when you do install a FreeBSD with BSD install, you're presented with three options when you get to the partitioning stage using... Mm-hmm. Guided mode, which kind of walks you through a couple of steps and you create the partitions and whatever. That actually starts a little C program and does it. Or you can do manual, where you just do it yourself. Or mm-hmm. you can use shell, where you drop to a shell and have to do it all yourself. Now, if you wanted to install with the root file system on ZFS, there was an article on the FreeBSD wiki and it was like 17 commands to type in that shell prompt to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what I did was created a fourth option in that menu that allows you to say, run that shell script for me. Although we extended it after that, after the initial writing of that on the airplane to EuroBSDCon, we've since extended it so that you can choose between GPT and MBR partitioning, whether mm-hmm. you want to do the little GNOP hack to force 4K sectors in case some of the drives lie, or if you have some 4K and some not 4K drives. Or even if you're not using 4K drives, you might want to use that because in the future you plan to replace those drives with 4K drives, right? And ZFS mm-hmm. has that ability to expand the pool if you just replace the drives it consists of. And so for a number of reasons, you might want to do 4K there. And then we went and extended it and added Geli support, which is disk encryption. So this happens mm-hmm. under ZFS, so it's not quite as good. And we've kind of discussed the advantages and disadvantages of that compared to PEFS used in PCBSD. But mm-hmm. basically you can choose to do that and it'll make a small 2 gigabyte boot partition that's not encrypted, which just...
That's a UFS,
right? No, it's actually ZFS as well. And so that'll boot up the system and just contains a kernel and nothing else. It'll start... It'll ask you for the password to decrypt the encrypted hard drives and then boot the rest mm-hmm. of the system off of that. There was a small bug there where after you finish booting, that small unencrypted pool wasn't getting mounted properly, but that's fixed in Beta 2.
That's fixed in Beta 2. Okay. Excellent. Well, that'll be interesting to definitely play with, see how that works
for you guys. So we'd love people to test that more. We're looking at also extending that some, support for Spark 64 maybe, but I don't know how... in demand that really is. But the biggest thing is some people would still want to use UFS, and currently mm-hmm. BSD install has no way to allow you to do like a gmir. If you have two drives and you want to mirror them, you have to use the shell mode and do it yourself. And combining gmir with GPT can be a bit of a pain because they both try to store their metadata in the same place, so you end up having to do mm-hmm. a gmir per partition instead of per disk. A kind of scripted version of that as well might be very useful to some people.
Wait, you're talking gmir with ZFS on top?
Gmir with UFS on top. No. Just as a separate option.
Okay.
And then the other one was extending what you can do with the ZFS. Like with the current implementation, you don't really pick mm-hmm. what data sets are created. It uses kind of what the community has decided is a good best practice.
This is a normal
and
data set.
You can provide a different one via a shell variable if you're scripting the install, but there's no graphical interface for it yet. So we're looking mm-hmm. at that, although it's quite complicated, and I don't imagine it'll be done in time for 10.0.
Probably not for 10, but that's...
But in the future, you'll be able to have a lot more control over the data sets as well, which is mm-hmm. of interest to me because, I have to do a couple of installs a week, and so, mm-hmm. Adding this ability so... I don't have to do... Basically, what I was doing on my servers was drop into that shell mode and then use fetch to pull a shell script off of my web server and run it.
Of all
with
your
all the commands all out of commands. That wiki, basically. Slightly modified, and then, I had a different shell script for whether I wanted it as a mirror or RAID Z or whatever, and it would do mm-hmm. all that. And this is just so much nicer. And it gives you a lot more control as well.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, next up here in the news, we're moving on to Asia, actually. Yep. We got Asia BSDCon 2014 has been announced. So for those who don't know, this is held in Tokyo every year. Yep. It's at the University of Tokyo there, and it's a BSD conference for anybody using FreeBSDNet, Open, Dragonfly, Darwin, macOS X. I mean, it's pretty much everybody's there. And Call for Papers is up now.
So you have to have your submissions for tutorials in by November 22nd and submissions for papers in by November 29th. About a month later, you'll find out whether your paper or tutorial was accepted, and then you have less than a month from then to actually get the tutorial materials and final papers into them because they actually make like a printed book called The Proceedings of Asian BSDCon that every attendee gets. And so you need to have the materials in ahead of time so that they can actually make a printed book out of it to give to everybody.
Which is actually really cool. I've been there 5 or 6 times now, and I got a little section on my bookshelf that's got all the books, and I can refer back to those and go, oh, yeah, here was that talk, and here's the paper he wrote. Oh, yeah, I can go refer and figure out what exactly, and I need to learn from that.
And there's usually some leftovers, and they sell them, so you can buy last year's book if you weren't there.
Sure. So it's definitely a good conference, and if anybody's interested in submitting talks, hit up the links in the show notes after we're done. Okay, so that's the news roundup for this week. Next up, should we do the tutorial?
No, we'll do the interview.
Okay, so let's introduce that then. Okay, so for our interview this week, Alan and I recorded with Paul Henningkamp while we were out at EuroBSDCon back in Malta a few weeks ago. And he's been around a while, done a lot of things, maybe some stuff you've heard of, like MD5 Crip, Jails, Varnish. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff Paul's
like doing. All over. I think when we talked to him, he said he joined the FreeBSD project about 6 hours into the project.
Very early on.
It's like he wasn't there for the founding because of time zones. He was asleep at the time. But when he woke up, he joined the project.
Which is very cool. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview. It was a lot of fun to record, and take it away.
So this week we got to interview Paul Henningkamp from the FreeBSD project. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Paul, for taking the time and just spending a little bit of time in this hot room with us out in Malta.
I want to say I was manhandled.
Right?
Yes. He's here against his will.
You'll get the money afterwards.
The reason why I can't see me move my arm is...
Well, anyway, just give the viewers a little bit of background on yourself or how you got started with the project.
So in the good old days, we're back in 1991 or 92. I was employed in a couple of Danish companies and used Unix to do whatever I did for a job. And back then, a Unix machine would set you back something like a salary in license cost. And then out came 386 BSD, which was Bill Jollett's port of the Berkeley kernel to the standard PC hardware. And we started playing with that. And it was pretty darn useless. If you press Control C, it would panic.
That's a feature.
That was a feature, yes. That was a null pointer dereference in the signal code. And out of that grew the FreeBSD project. So I'm one. I think I can't claim to be a founding father of the FreeBSD project for the reason that I was asleep in Denmark while they did the deal back in the US. But I was certainly on board within the first 6 hours. So I've been on FreeBSD from the start. And well, the rest is history. Are we done?
Well, so since you've been there so long, you had your hand in a lot of the major core features. Can you tell us a couple of the things that have your stamp on them?
What can we blame you for? That's all we're asking.
I'm actually thinking the negative list might be faster. I have not had anything to do with IP version 6. That's not my fault. No, I mean, in the early years, it was pretty widely roaming. There was a lot of things to fix, a lot of low-hanging fruit. I guess one of the most visible pieces of my code that people have been familiar with is sysinstall, the installer we wrote. You should really ask Jordan about that one. We wrote an interim installer back in 1994 just to get the 2.0 release out, and it got replaced 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
That's pretty good for an interim program.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of kernel work, DevFS, Jails, Geom, I sanitized the entire Vnode VFS interface. Did a lot of what I call code hygiene, you know, adding consts, prototypes, that kind of stuff. I really can't remember all of it. And every so often I'll look at code and say, what idiot did this? And then, you know, SVN blame. It's like, oh. I still have that experience every so often. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate for about the first 10 years of the project to have employment that allowed me to work on FreeBSD, even though FreeBSD was not a major priority for my employer. Mm. But that gave me a lot of time to improve FreeBSD and actually use FreeBSD to do really cool things with it. Mm-hmm. So you use SVN blame. I can't remember all of it. That's a lot of device driver work in conjunction with DevFS.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that.
Oh, very cool. Well, how about the jails thing? There's a lot. I'm sure you could tell us about how jails got started.
Jails are kind of interesting because I had made a sort of a quick hack I'd used myself actually during the release process. Mm-hmm. Changeroot was actually originally made so that you could make releases at Berkeley University. And they kind of half-baked on a number of levels. And I kind of polished that up a little bit and added some features, but we ended up not using it for building releases. We found another way to build a clean release. Mm-hmm. Then time make release, make file is also my fault. Then this dude from South Carolina contacted me because he had this idea for running multiple different versions of Apache and MySQL on the same server for his web hosting business. Mm-hmm. And would it be possible to do that? And I'm like, I have no idea. We chatted about it a bit. And then he basically offered to fund me developing something that could do that. That's basically how jails came up. And the deal was he would pay for the development, and then after 1 year I could commit them to FreeBSD. And that's what happened. And he sold his .com web hosting business and bought his BMW and all that. And then I wrote up a paper together with Robert Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Robert had not really been involved in the development of it, but Robert was... Robert is very good at formulating concepts, something I'm not always good at. So I teamed up with Robert to write the paper, and we presented it at the same conference in Maastricht, 1998 or something like that. That must have been 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of started a kind of a trend. I wouldn't say that it in any way have affected the modern virtualization movement as much as it should. But the thing about jails is that it's like a one-way mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you run a VMware or anything like that, you get a perfect emulated machine.
Sure.
Which means if somebody roots your machine, you still have to log in through SSH so they can snoop your password. Whereas if you run it in a jail, you can stand on the main machine and look into the jail, and they won't spot another process in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
They won't be able to see that you're spying on them. And a lot of security researchers use that for honeypots and stuff like that. And people started doing things like putting their entire web server into a jail,
mm-hmm.
and having another jail ready and set to go. And the first moment you detect any kind of defacement, you just shut down that jail, copy the other one over, and start it again. So you can deface the website for like 30 seconds.
Hmm.
After about 17 tries, that's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
And one particular US agency had for legacy reason to run a nightmare of a web application written in PHP. It was not full of holes. There were places that didn't have any holes. They were sure about that. But basically what they did, that they ran it in a jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took the snapshot whenever it got defaced or anything like that. And then they found that bug and closed that and waited for the next one to come. And that aspect of jails it's somewhat, a lot of people are aware of it, but the real virtualization people would really like people not to be aware of it. They
sure.
want to sell the expensive licenses,
yeah,
right?
VMware.
But it's now been improved further. Now we have virtual network stack and so on. Mm-hmm. So now we're in sort of the kernel has gone meta. So instead of the good old days where you booted your kernel, you got in single user, got a shell, and everything stops here. Now you can boot a kernel, and then you can start a number of environments, each in their own jail with their own network stack and all this stuff. And that's, you get much more money out of your hardware than running VMware or something like that.
Sure, sure.
So that's, intellectually, I consider that one of the big projects I've done in FreeBSD.
Because I use the features of jails like that a lot, because I can take a jail, I can pick it up and move it to another machine and just start it.
Yeah.
And that solves a lot of problems.
Yeah, but I mean, you can do that with a virtual machine also.
Right.
The thing that makes jails special is that you can stand outside and look into them without being seen.
For our CDN, that's how our billing system works, is we have a bunch of jails for different things, and then the billing system sits on the host, and it can peek into all of the jails at once.
Exactly. That kind of one-way mirror is a very strong feature in a security environment, and I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah, definitely. And if the jail's down, you can actually still get into it. Whereas if your VM goes down, you got to find a way to boot it.
Yeah, I mean, the security environment now is radically different from what it used to be, and the machine power is radically different. So we have to think security in a different way than we used to do.
Sure.
And it's one of the things I've done. I'm doing Varnish these days, a web accelerator, and one of the things I'm doing there is also trying to look at this partitioning. How can we make domains of trust so that if people compromise one of them, they don't compromise all of it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
As NSA has recently learned, that if somebody has user ID 0, you have no idea what they've been doing.
Sure.
They should have used jails.
Yeah. Get off of Linux.
Also that. But we have to, the title of the jail paper is Confining the Omnipotent Root.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still working on that one, and we still need to work more on it, because it's, from an operational point of view, it's not okay that the most trusted person in the system is some scruffy dude down in the IT department.
Sure.
So, more work to be done.
Yeah, it's Capsicum kind of comes into that, where you can make the application not have the privileges when it doesn't need it.
I mean, the Unix security model is brilliantly simple if you have somebody you trust ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I guess at Bell Labs they trusted Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie, and they didn't have a problem with that. Once you have to partition trust, you have to be able to lower privilege for whatever you start. And one of the weird things in Unix is you're not allowed to do change root unless you're root.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sane reason why a regular user should not be able to say, I don't really trust this program, run it in a sandbox for me.
Mm-hmm. That's something we're actually doing with our new package container for PBIs, is it's rooting into a virtual user local and saying, let's run this away from everything else, just to be on the safe side.
I mean, user ports, we should assign a user ID for each of them and all something. but Capsicum is Robert taking, I guess, the spirit of the jail and running with it, and combining it with a lot of other older ideas. Capability is not a new thing, but it's kind of been forgotten somewhere in the 80s. And Capsicum is really interesting. I mean, we're approaching now the point where we would be able to write a quality... We have the operating system components now to make Windows 3.11 as it should have been done. To not totally ruin computing for all of mankind. For instance, being able to have clearly indicate where your ambient authority goes, as in, if I move this file from here to there, it means I know I move it. Don't execute it just because I insert a floppy disk or a CD-ROM or something like that.
Sure.
The fact that the mainstream operating systems didn't have a security design or didn't consider that kind of thing a problem has kind of lost us 20 years in reliable, trustworthy computing. And I guess we'll catch up now with the NSA news. People will start taking security more seriously. Time will tell.
Have you done anything on the encryption side of the security? Is that?
Yes.
Oh. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen like...
I brought a password scrambler for FreeBSD 2.0. We couldn't export crypto out of US.
Mm-hmm.
So FreeBSD had a secure distribution that was distributed out of South Africa.
Oh.
Because Mark Murray was pretty sure the police would never find him there or something. But we couldn't ship a disencryption algorithm without getting loads of paperwork and whatever, whatever. So somebody had cooked up a password scrambler that was not very good. And we were in violent agreement. We couldn't ship FreeBSD 2.0 with that one. And since we couldn't do the standard Unix password scrambler because that was desk-based, we were kind of stuck. So I sat down and thought about it for a couple of days, and then I hacked together in one afternoon the infamous MD5 crypt. And slammed that in and said, live with it. And through path of weirdness, that one also was the first one that got the BeerWare license. There was a lot of the GNU versus BSD license, yada, 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 and there's been ever since. And I'm kind of tired of that because I write code because people can use it. So I slammed the BeerWare license on that one and forgot everything about it for a couple of years. Then one day, back in Denmark, we got a, I think, 9.21 on the Cisco router. And, you know, enable password, blah, blah, blah. And it comes back. It says, $1, blah, 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 blah. I was like, that looks weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Check it out. Yes, that's compatible with FreeBSD. So one of the FreeBSD committers worked at Cisco. I knew that. So I sent him an email saying, could you kind of peek over in that part of the code and see if it says anything about beer? And he's like, yes, it does. And sort of unbeknownst to me, MD5 crypt had crept in anywhere, everywhere. Shockwave flash animations used it for password protection. Linux, glibc had re-implemented it, carefully not saying a word about where they got it from.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
At one point I estimated that about 50% of the internet's integrity was protected by MD5 crypt. I found that a bit scary because it was literally a piece of code I've hacked up. I mean, the big thing about MD5 crypt was I put $1 in front of it so you could change the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the idea is you can change the algorithm every 2 years to make sure it's strong enough. And of course nobody did that. The same algorithm kept running and running and running.
Now it's 20 years later.
Yes. And finally a couple of years ago, actually it's probably only 1 year ago or something, I had to put a stake in the ground and say, if your password looks like $1, it's not safe anymore. Mm-hmm. You have to do something now. And had to sort of orchestra a little bit of a campaign to make sure the message got out because I had no idea where it needed to go to.
Sure, right. There's so many people using it that you didn't know about.
All these embedded places and apps.
Yeah, who knows where it went. So I that's the first time I've ever consciously done a bit of marketing, kind of investigating how do you get something to become a meme on the net. What are the triggers you have to hit to get this, you know, to hit Reddit, to hit Hacker News, to hit Slashdot and all this. And it went pretty well. I think the message got out. But that was kind of that's the first time I've done a code recall. General Motors is terribly sorry about your car, but you have to return it.
Yeah.
So that was a weird sort of experience. In particular, it's weird that people would trust a piece of code that's thrown together that way. And it contains a pretty obvious bug that doesn't affect the security, it just makes the algorithm even more weird. And I think I've had about 5 or 6 people spot that one. Everybody else is just, okay, it's probably supposed to be that one.
Copy and paste.
And one of the more weird experiences is that I know it's been ported to JavaScript and COBOL. So that bit of code had a weird history.
Sure.
And then as part of a DARPA contract, Robert pulled in. The one that where I built GEOM, the pluggable I/O disk I/O structure there. Also did an encrypted, not file system, but a disk encryption for full partition encryption. And that was kind of interesting because I took a usability angle on it and talked to a lot of weird people who do weird stuff. A lot of them can't talk about what they do or who their employer is and stuff like that. But many of them uses encryption to protect their data. And that was kind of an interesting experience too. And that's also being used against my, I guess, by now, better judgment now. But it has some usability features that apparently other products have not caught up with yet. One of them being it doesn't automatically send your key to the NSA.
Well, that is definitely helpful.
I can see why people want that feature.
Yes, yeah. It's become very popular recently.
Yeah, it's one of those things. You share one secret with a friend, next thing you know, it's out to everyone. So who are they sharing it with next?
Yeah, exactly.
So which crypto layer is that?
It's basically AES-based.
Right, but is it Jelly or GDBD?
That's GBD.
Okay, okay.
Jelly is written by Papel. One of the things that, about GBD is that a crypto box has three. It has an input, it has a key, and it has an output. And in theory, you can make your attack better if you can get access to manipulate two of them. So what it did in GBD is that the key is always random. And then we store the random keys encrypted also. And that means you do not have a two-way leverage because you cannot write a sector with one set of data and then write it with another sector of data, and it will be two different keys. So it doesn't give you a differential attack. Of course, AES is proven to be resistant against the differential attack, so that may not be important, but with crypto you can never be too safe.
You can never be too paranoid.
No, apparently not.
What do you use on your personal systems now? For
I'm a firm believer in eating my own dog food. So my laptop runs FreeBSD current.
Oh, okay.
It's been doing that since 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And my partitions are encrypted with GBD.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. No. If you don't run your own code, you're stuck. You're in a...
Yep.
But if you don't eat your own dog food, I don't believe your dog food.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
Well, very cool. This is fantastic. Just a lot of great information on the history of this. Any other questions you want to ask, Alan?
Is there anything you're working on now?
Right now, most of my time is being taken up by Varnish.
So what are you doing new in Varnish? I'm a big consumer of Varnish.
Everybody is. 10% of the content of the net goes from Varnish these days. Right now, we are laying our final hands, our dirty little hands, on Varnish Release 4, 4.0. We want to. We're trying to take sort of the same attitude to releases as FreeBSD. So it does server releases where you introduce major changes in .1, .2, .3, and so on. So 4.0 changes a lot of things. People will have to rewrite their configurations and stuff like that. And they'll hate me for it, and then afterwards they'll hopefully love me for some of it. So we'll try to do a. It's more modular. You can pull in modules now to do weird functions like GeoIP or whatever you want to do, and streaming and conditional fetches to the backends. And we're also putting in some groundwork for a modular processing stack, somewhat like, not quite like Apache's Bucket Brigade, but somewhat similar. So you can stick in levels of processing and do I don't know, virus scans if you think that helps your security. So. And then we just on Wednesday had the final status meeting on a project I did for ESO, the European Southern Observatory. They want to build a really large telescope in Chile with a 39-meter main mirror. If you point that at the sun, you get 1 megawatt of energy. So don't do that.
Yeah.
And this uses adaptive optics. You can't make a mirror that stays in shape. So you have these very thin mirrors you can deform. And you need to do that, a lot of calculations to know how to deform them in real time. And typically that's, you pull up a box in the rack full of FPGAs and DSPs, chips and stuff like that. And then 5-10 years later, you can't get spare parts and the company went bankrupt. And 50 years later, you have all these kind of, oh, don't touch this, it's working now.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're looking to go to a COTS platform. So basically our task was to build a prototype on regular PCs. And we did that, and it's working.
And that's on FreeBSD?
That's on FreeBSD, and very it's cool. Actually, more than that, it's on a unchanged FreeBSD 9 kernel.
Oh.
Not one single modification to the kernel. It's all done from userland, using a couple of slightly dirty tricks. But we've met the spec, and once Brazil releases the money, they'll start building this telescope.
That is impressive. That's really cool.
It's a very cool project.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're giving a talk on that later at the conference.
I have a talk about
it. Will they be recording it?
No, well, they will be, I think. And then they'll be up on YouTube.
Well, for the listeners, go find it later. It's going to be really cool. You got to hear that.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting what they can see with that telescope.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally new capability.
Oh, awesome.
Hubble spent, I think, 6 weeks staring at the same place to take the deep field.
Mm-hmm.
And the ELT would do that in about half an hour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, that's a hope.
Yeah. Well, if anything goes wrong, hopefully it won't be the FreeBSD side.
I don't know whether, that's a 10-year lead time on a telescope like that.
Sure.
You start out, you know, taking the top of the mountain, building a very, very large building that can rotate and stuff like that.
Wow.
So they'll probably open around 2025, maybe, would be realistic. So it's not a quick project. And whether it will be running FreeBSD, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I would prefer they do, but I'm not actually militant about what operating system people run. It would be pointless for them to build a telescope in Chile, 200 kilometers up the mountain, and have one set of FreeBSD machines there and everything else being Linux or VxWorks or something.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
There's a top-level management where I look at that and say, okay, if you can do it on FreeBSD, you can probably also do it on Linux.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to have this just for that special kind of thing.
Sure.
I'm, of course, trying to explain to them that FreeBSD is much better than Linux in all respects, so you should do it the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll probably not work.
Although there was an interesting talk at BSDCAN earlier this year about convincing management that they should use FreeBSD instead of Linux.
Yes. It's actually easy to convince people to use FreeBSD once you get to talk to them. The problem here is that, first of all, these are not management. These are scientists.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if they could, they would run the entire telescope on MATLAB.
Right.
And if not MATLAB, Fortran.
Right.
A lot of the hardware is special.
Right.
And mm-hmm. even once you build the telescope, the actual instruments are pluggable. So you'll have University of Hubble, North Dakota, come up with this special fancy detector, and
mm-hmm.
and they'll come down there with boxes of wires and hook that up to the telescope. So it is what used to be hailed as a heterogeneous environment.
Mm-hmm.
They have all kinds of different hardware.
Right.
So one more or less is not going to break their back,
mm-hmm.
In that sense. But there would be advantages for them to have some bit of standard, because mm-hmm. this will probably be a telescope with its own computing center. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other telescopes have, you know, racks of equipment, but this one will probably have a computing center.
Just to process all the data and everything.
Yeah, but a lot of the things we used to do in custom hardware
mm-hmm.
is done on PCs now. Your ventilation system,
sure.
Yeah, that comes with a Windows XP machine. 3.11, oh, well. stuff like that. Your diesel generators come with a PC that
mm-hmm.
you know, takes care of the lubrication schedule and stuff like that. So they will have a lot of PCs one way or another. Live with it,
yeah,
and try to control it somehow. So.
Well, very cool. This was a fantastic interview.
Yes.
Thank
you're
you so
welcome.
Much for spending the time to come up and talk
can
to us about it.
Can you release the
handcuff? Yes, right. We will let you go now. You can back to your previously scheduled entertainment. Yeah. So thank you again, Paul.
You're welcome.
So next up in our tutorial segment, this week we're going to be looking at everything you need to know about jails, but kind of a little background on this. So, of course, virtualization is a big part of security these days. Why would we dedicate an entire machine to one specific service when you can make a virtual machine and do many things? I mean, that's why we have multiple cores, right? So another option is to run just the one service alongside the rest of the machine. But if someone breaks into one service, then of course they can access everything. They've got the whole box. So virtual machines mostly solve the isolation issue, but they have some drawbacks. And the main problem, of course, is performance overhead. There are speed penalties when running things in a VM, everything from the disk I/O to emulated NICs, CPU overhead, everything has a cost associated with it. However, on modern hardware, the CPU performance has become a lot better. But what if there's another solution? What if there was an extremely lightweight virtualization solution without any of these performance drawbacks and with a close attention paid to security? Well, on FreeBSD there is, and with our interview with Paul, we heard a little bit about jails. But what jails are is an isolated virtual instance of FreeBSD that all run on the same kernel. So there's no performance hit at all, even with the network stack and disk I/O. Cool thing is, if someone breaks into your jail and got root, They're locked to that file system. They cannot get out of the jail. There's also a lot of other forceful limits in place, so you'll want to check out the docs for more information. I know you can do process resource control, a lot of cool stuff with jails. You can deploy literally hundreds, or I've heard of thousands of jails on a system with very little resources. They use pretty much no extra RAM aside from the apps you run within them. So today we're going to be looking at a really cool utility called EasyJail for creating, updating, and managing jails. You can still do things the traditional way by looking at the FreeBSD handbook and run the jail command manually, but EasyJail is going to automate a lot of it and make it just a lot more easy, right? So let's get started by installing it from ports or PackageNG. So take it away here, Alan.
So I've just installed it from ports, and I'm now doing the EasyJail admin-install command. Basically, what this does is goes out and gets a copy of FreeBSD from the FTP site and installs it into a directory, by default, /user/jail/basejail. And so what it will do is install the entire OS into a subdirectory, and then for each jail, it will mount that directory read-only using nullfs into each jail. And then using some clever symbolic links, it means that the base system on every jail is the same read-only base jail, so that when it comes time to upgrade your 100 or 1,000 jails you're running on the machine, you update the base jail once, and now all your virtual machines are updated.
Well, that's one thing. I don't know if Paul mentioned it in our interview now, but I know talking to him, he had talked about jails being a one-way mirror, where if you're on the host, you can actually peek into what's going on in the jails. And since it's just a directory, that makes it really easy to do. It's not like you got to bring up a VDisk image and actually load the machine to analyze it. You can even take the jail down and then peek in, see what's going on.
Exactly. And the other thing with that is... sorry, I forgot my point. the jails, you don't have a fixed disk size, right? When you create a virtual machine, you have to create a virtual image that says, oh, the virtual disk is going to be 16 gigabytes. Now, things have changed over the last couple of years where it's a little easier to grow a disk image. You know, the tools in VMware, VirtualBox, will let you increase the size, and then inside the OS in there will hopefully let you grow it. But with jails, because it's just a directory on the host file system, you have access to all of the space that was on the host. So it makes it a lot easier to avoid, you know, free space fragmentation, because the files
If you're using something like ZFS as well, you can start setting quotas for your jail underneath, and say you add some extra disks to your Z pool. Well, magically, here's an extra couple terabytes for my jails, and I didn't have to touch anything in the configuration, which is just really stinking
cool. And you can, that way you can snapshot and clone them, and you can do all kinds of stuff. You've made a utility kind of similar to EasyJail called Warden, right? And that originally designed to be graphical, but has a text interface now as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very similar to EasyJail. We don't do some of the same tricks as the nullfs mounts, but we do a lot of ZFS dataset stuff.
Right, the nullfs mounts were only really there because doing it with ZFS wasn't an option originally, so you had to do this nullfs. Now you could just make the root dataset and clone it or something instead, right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we do. We create a clean and then clone them, and there you go. You can have a jail rolled out in a few seconds.
Yep. And then so once you have EasyJail installed, EasyJail is installed, but now once we have FreeBSD installed, I'll just switch over to another machine here because the download's going really slow. It must be hitting the wrong mirror. Anyway, you can, when you want to update, you can just do EasyJail admin update -u, and it'll use FreeBSD update to update the base jail. And pulls down all the latest security patches and everything, and now all your jails are up to date.
Which is really cool. That's how we do it in Warden too. It just runs FreeBSD update or PackageNG upgrade inside the jails and just brings them all up to speed.
Also, you can update your ports tree with PortSnap. EasyJail will keep one copy of the ports tree for all of your jails to avoid having all that excess stuff laying around. And so you have to update that ports tree every once in a while. So just easyjail-admin update, and then it's capital P to do only the ports tree. And it will, fetch the deltas for the last week or so and update the ports tree. This is very handy, especially if you're using your jails to, keep track of different versions of software. Like at ScaleEngine, in our web hosting section, we have different jails for, you know, one's running PHP 5.3 and one's running 5.4.
Sure.
And then we can kind of divide up our customers depending how they, which one they want and so on.
Oh, that's very cool.
So then when we get around to actually creating the jails, jails by default share an IP address with the host. So normally you wouldn't use your main IP address because then if you start SSH, things, bad things happen. But basically, if you have a second IP address on the machine, then you can say, hey, the jail has access to this IP address and only this IP address. And then any service that's listening in the jail will accept on that. And then if you, on the host, if you have a service running on like the wildcard on every IP address, if the jail is running that service, it'll hit the jail. But if the jail isn't, it'll fall through and hit the host.
Fall back. Yeah, very cool.
Which is extremely helpful and slightly confusing every once in a while. You know, if you forget to...
I don't see it in... I was going to ask you, I don't see it in the tutorial, but does EasyJail do anything with vImage yet or not?
No, but that's another option is using vImage, which instead of sharing an IP address off the host, allows you to fully virtualize the networking stack and actually do more complicated setups.
Yeah, you actually get like a network card in the jail, which is pretty stinking cool. That's how you would do like broadcast support within a jail.
So then if you need to, if you're going to set up a jail, you need to add that IP address to your system. So you can do that with the ifconfig alias. Or actually, EasyJail has a system for managing this. So if we decide to create a new jail, or first we need to enable EasyJail, sorry.
Yep.
So we need to go and put this EasyJail underscore enable equals yes. And this will start EasyJail at boot time. And EasyJail will bring up all the jails that you have configured to start automatically, which is the default. You can disable a jail, but by default, all the jails will start automatically. And if we do JLS, you can see that there's no jails running right now. So if I create a new jail, I can just do easyjailadmin create, and then I'll create a new one. Say we're going to run the website for bsdnow.tv in a jail. And then I provide the host name, which is going to be the name of the jail, and then I can provide the IP address. Or I can cheat, and if I do the syntax of the name of the network driver, so EM0 is my Intel network card in this virtual machine, and then the pipe character, so I've coded it to avoid the pipe character being interpreted by the shell, and then put in some new IP address, then, so you can see now, that IP address doesn't actually exist on my virtual machine. But when I start that virtual machine,
gets created, right?
EasyJail will automatically add that IP address to my system as an alias, as you can see there. And now when we do JLS, we see that we have a jail running. You can also do EasyJail-admin list, and it will show all of your jails, including the ones that aren't running, which is handy. And you can see that each of these jails is just a directory under user jails on my host file system.
Sure.
And if you have, if you enable the ZFS options in easyjail.conf, it'll create a separate ZFS dataset for each jail.
So I know a jail supports multiple addresses for jails. It does IPv6 as well. I assume EasyJail does IPv6 also, right?
Yep. If you want to have multiple IP addresses, you just comma separate them when you're configuring them.
There you go.
So now what we can do is we can do EasyJail console and then the name of the running jail, and it will actually log us into that jail. And now, so when we're on top, we see only the base things in the jail are running.
Yep.
So now, if I just leave something running, now when I run top on the host, you can see there's a lot more stuff running. But if I use press J, it will show the jail number as an extra column, and we can see the processes from inside the jail running here.
This is that whole one-way mirror thing we're talking about.
On the host,
you can peek into any of
on
them.
On the host, you see all of the jails, and you can look in and see what they're doing, what processes are running, and stuff like that. In the ports tree, there's a port, I think, I forget what it's called, but I think it's called jail utils or something. And it provides things like JTOP, where you can say, you know, JTOP jail number 2, and it'll show you the top of only the processes running in jail number 2, and things like that. So you can do all kinds of things like that.
this becomes handy for administration too, because I only got to run one SSH session on the host, and then I can get in and manage, you know, X hundreds of jails without needing to run SSH in each one, and then worry about, you know, monitoring for brute force attacks on each one. You know, it just makes this a lot more simple.
So you can also do some basic resource limiting. We can say only use CPU number 0 for this jail. And now it basically uses the CPU set command to only allow the processes in this jail to run on CPU ID number 0. So that means my second or third CPU is free to run other stuff. So I can balance different jails on different CPUs, kind of like you do with virtual machines.
And, sure.
Also, there's more robust resource control, the RCTL system and jail resource controls. And resource limits, and we got a link to some of the wiki stuff there if you wanted to get to take a look at that.
Yeah, you can get pretty in depth with this if you want. Well, very cool. So that's looks like that's most of the tutorial there, right? Okay. So somebody was asking in the chat about the Warden, and it's very similar to what we're seeing here. It's got a command line interface, but it's also got a graphical Qt GUI. So if you want to be able to do this graphically and just point and click and say create a jail or do ZFS snapshots on a jail, you can schedule that all.
And via the Warden also have a couple of other types of jails, right? Like Linux jails?
Yeah, we have Linux jails where you can extract Linux into a jail and essentially start it up. And when you log in, it thinks it's a Linux box, even though it's running through Linux compatibility. And then we have something fancy called a port jail, which basically it uses the jail system to allow you to install X applications and other things and run those out of a jail. So if you got something you want to run that needs graphical capabilities and you don't really want it running on your host for maybe security reasons, you can virtualize that.
Yeah, kind of like we did last week, except for not remotely.
Yep, so that would be local.
The performance penalty of using VNC, but...
Correct. But it's a great way as a ports developer. It's an easy way for me to say, okay, I'm going to try this experimental Firefox and build it in a jail without trashing my Firefox
or just
system.
You know, doing things like when you're building a jail, when you're building a port, you have to make sure that the port's not leaving any files behind. If you create a fresh jail, snapshot it, do your port install, do the port uninstall, then you can use the ZFS diff command to say, show me any files that are modified, added, or removed since this snapshot. And then it's like, oh, look. There's this straggler file, or no, I did it all right, and so on and so on.
Another thing is if you're running Linux applications, there's a fair number of Linux ports in the FreeBSD port tree. You could easily say, okay, I want a jail that uses Fedora Core this version and then runs this app, but then I got a conflicting Fedora Core version installed in another jail that runs another app. It just gives you a way to virtualize those.
Yep.
Okay. So next up, we're going to go through a quick news roundup, all the things that have happened in the BSD community in the last week. So what we got starting here,
The first one is that in OpenBSD, PF has the new packet queuing system.
Okay.
So it's a new bandwidth shaping subsystem. It's kernel side, and it uses the HFSC algorithm instead of alt queue.
Okay. So they're going to be retiring alt queues?
Basically the new one would be the default, I think.
Okay, very cool. So they're encouraging everyone to migrate. Excellent. So next up, we have Dragonfly news. Dragonfly has imported the FreeBSD KMS driver. So this looks like it's for the AMD video drivers.
Yeah, AMD Radeon video drivers.
Okay, and they ported that over from the FreeBSD ports, and I imagine the kernel bits as well.
Yes, and originally that was, I think, from Linux. So it, through a couple of layers, it got into Dragonfly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, very cool.
OpenBSD had it first, and then FreeBSD got it, and now Dragonfly.
It's such a loving community, these BSDs, how they share so much.
Well, there's no sense wasting effort.
That's right. So next up, something actually PCBSD related. We started doing a weekly feature digest that Josh Smith, one of our guys, is going to be posting. Every Friday is what we're looking at, just kind of a quick heads up. This is what changed this week. This is what got fixed. This is what we're working on, just to keep the community abreast of new features and changes.
So you're going to have new changes every week.
Well, maybe not spectacular some weeks, but you know, when there's bug fixes and stuff, it's nice to know that got addressed and at least get that info out there.
That kind of communications is something that's kind of lacking in a bunch of places where it's like, you know, you find out even just knowing that when there is a bug, you know, I was the victim of a problem in FreeBSD 9.0 where there was a memory leak in the NFS server. And it was a known issue and seemed everybody to know about it, but I was like, where's all my RAM? And then while Googling for it, eventually I found it. It's like, oh, here's the problem. Here's the patch. It's fixed in 9 stable, but you'd have to rate for 9.1 to get it via FreeBSD update.
That's what we're trying to fix, because not everyone's going to go read the Git commit logs and then monitor the tracked database every week. You know, we're going to try and summarize that for you so you can have one blog post or email and just go, oh, okay, that got fixed this week, or here's a known issue they're working on. Just to kind of keep everyone up to date. All right, so what's up next here?
The other one is, we talked a little bit on TechSnap last week, but Google is, they thought about doing bug bounties for open source software. But from their experience with bug bounties, they said they got so many reports of things that weren't really bugs that they didn't want to subject open source projects to all these spurious reports. Especially, you know, their open source communities, you know, people are volunteering their time and people don't really have that much time to go through thousands of bogus bug reports. So instead of that, what they're doing is offering the developers funds for implementing security improvement features. So specifically, you know, if you add a new security feature to OpenSSH, then you're eligible for a Google bounty of between $500 and $3,113.70.
Well, that's really cool. That's a great way to start seeing some beefed up security in some of these products.
Currently, the projects that are in scope are core infrastructure network services like OpenSSH, Bind, and the ISC DHCP server. Image parsers like libjpg, jpeg turbo, libpng, and giflib. The open source foundations of Google Chrome and Blink. High impact libraries like OpenSSL and zlib. And security critically and commonly used bits of the Linux kernel like KVM. So if you do something like implementing privilege separation, memory allocation hardening, cleaning up integer arithmetic, so, you know, avoiding integer overflows, things like that. Systematic fixes for specific types of race conditions, eliminating error-prone design patterns, all that kind of stuff, then you're eligible for these rewards. And also in the future, they talked about extending this to include other things like Apache and Nginx and other commonly used applications. They have SendMail, PostFix, XIM, GCC, binutils, LLVM, OpenVPN, all that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting
we'll
to see when they get around
to that. In the show notes too. You guys definitely take a look at that if that's something you're interested in making a little cash on the side.
Yeah, it's just, I think, an extra push in the right direction to get developers to work on some of this less glamorous stuff.
Okay, excellent. Well, that's the end of the news roundup for the week. Next up, we got some feedback and questions from you, the audience. Next up, now time for some feedback from you, the audience. So what's our first question here this week,
Alan? The first one is about jail recommendations, which kind of fits with our theme today.
That actually works.
Derek writes in and says that he's cutting his teeth on jails for about the past month or so, and he's finding that there's not a whole lot of reliable information about doing vimage and pf together and trying to do, you know, nat out of the jails using epairs.
Yeah, it looks like he read some comments on our forums that pf may have some issues with vnet jails, and yeah, that's actually something we ran into when we were doing warden work. I'm not sure if those bugs have all been fixed in 10 yet. They may be. I think I heard that that's where they were corrected. Mm-hmm. So if you're still on, it looks like 9.1, you're probably going to run into issues. Yep. Their IPFW is what we ended up having to use to make the vimage stuff work on the older FreeBSDs.
Yeah, I don't remember what the specific conflict was between the vimage stuff and PF, but it...
I remember it caused kernel panic. So it was bad. Definitely not good.
Yeah, the issue I ran into was that what I really wanted was to have a different default gateway in the jail than on the host, and I didn't really have a way to do that. So I had to... So a lot of my jails run with internal IP addresses and then get natted at the end. And so I just had to add some extra rules to my firewall at the edge of my network, or my router at the edge of my network.
Yeah. And,
you know, have it all happen when there.
In the right place.
But I'd rather have it done differently, but I'd have to set up vImage and all that.
Well, just as a heads up, vImage is a nice feature. It does have some quirks. We're not shipping with it on anymore in PCBSD. We found too many cases where it was still causing kernel panics, especially if you're on a system with like a 3G card or various types of modems, LAN, etc. Yeah. It just still needs some work, I think, before it's stable enough to flip it back on again everywhere.
Yeah, but there's some stuff out there. But yeah, there's not that much documentation on it yet because it's still kind of a bleeding edge feature.
Sure, it is. So he was basically asking, you know, what we think regarding jail networking, what's known to work and what should be avoided. And I think that's pretty much it. I mean, if you're going to use vImage, knows that there's some caveats with it. I would try and run it on a newer 9.2 or 10 when it releases here in this next month. Hopefully some of those kernel panics and issues have been fixed and issues with PF at that point. But if you find problems, of course, open a FreeBSD PR and hopefully someone will take a look at it pretty quick. Okay, so next question here from, looks like Alexander?
Yes, Cal Alexander.
Okay.
So he's saying he's been developing some PHP web pages over the years, mostly for fun, but whatever. And he's looking at ways to deploy the new versions of the pages. And he's looking at different version control systems, and he's having a hard time picking one due to his limited knowledge and things like that. So what do you use for version control?
Well, we've kind of run the gamut. We started with CVS back in the day, went to Subversion, and we're on Git now. Yeah. Personally, I've enjoyed Git the most out of all of them. We have a GitHub account, and I kind of like the social aspects and being able to accept push and pull requests via GitHub. But that would be more for like a public project. Right. It's still handy though to be able to clone the entire repo and then deal with it offline, just like you're on the host system. So. Git seems to be the hot thing at the moment, although Subversion may work fine for your use case. I guess it just depends on what seems to click with you and make the most sense and seems to be the least bit of setup if you just want something that you can roll out quickly.
Right, I guess it also depends on your development model. If it's centralized, then something centralized like SVN makes sense. But if it's distributed, then you need it to be able, whether you need to be able to work offline. And, you know, there's definitely advantages to being able to save your progress, you know, commits offline and then merge them in later.
Yeah, if it's not going to be public, I mean, that completely changes the game. But if you're going to do public repos, I've really appreciated the ability to pull stuff with Git. I can point it at the FreeBSD Git repo and then pull their changes into my branch, commit them, and it's just a great way to merge my stuff with theirs. So it's been handy. SVN made that rather difficult.
Yeah, or even like one place where I found GitHub kind of useful was there was a project called Pico CMS. It's actually the one we use for the PCBSD, or sorry, the BSD Now website. You know, you write your web pages in Markdown and it renders them. But it was tripping over the .svn files because we keep all of the web pages in source control since they're all text files. And so it was basically adding the .svn links to the menus and recursing them and finding like the temporary copies of the files in there and basically having every version of every web page was in the menu.
Oh, man.
And so I went to their GitHub and you know, without even just using the website, I was able to do a pull request saying, you know, add this extra if statement that says, you know, if the name of the directory or the name of the file that you're going to recurse through starts with a dot, ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it was just adding an extra thing to an existing
statement.
And, you know, I did that with the editor right on the GitHub website. I didn't have to go install Git or learn how to use it. And it was very powerful that way.
Well, yeah, the thing about using something like GitHub for me, so I'm on the road a lot, and sometimes it's like I just got access to a web browser. Oh, look, a pull request came in. I can look at the diff right in my web browser and say, that's neat, commit, done. It's like I didn't even have to log in. I didn't have to pull it down to my repo or anything. It's able to commit it right there through the web, which is pretty handy.
So his question was actually about deploying stuff. The way I've done it in the past is I would, on the web server, have an SVN checkout to a temporary directory and then rsync that into the web directory. Rather than the SVN checkout, I think I would do an SVN export, which excludes all the metadata that way, and throws all the files into a temporary directory and then rsync those into the main one. The main reason for the rsync was to make sure the modified dates got set properly, so that my caching system wouldn't trip over it, or you know, NFS caching, or specifically the PHP opcode caching, which is based on the modified date of the files. And so it would make sure all the files were updated atomically as well. So rather than writing the file, it writes it all to a temporary file and then renames it into place, so that you're never in the instance of reading a half-written file.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely
so cool. So that's how I do it, is do basically an export of whatever branch or head of the repo, and then rsync it into the web root to make sure that it's all done atomically, and that the last modified data on the files aren't forged, so that the web server handles everything gracefully.
All right. Well, I hope that answers your question, gives you some advice on what direction to start looking in.
Yep.
Okay, next up, we got something from Ryan. First off, he says he's loving BSD now. He's been a longtime Linux enthusiast and always wondered what was going on the BSD side of the world. So he said he's all pumped up about hearing about the great work in the community. Please give up the great work. Thank you, Ryan. And it looks like he has a question here about S-Tunnel. Yep. And in episode 3, we talked about act as man in the middle between local clients and SSLs. Would using RelayD as a man in the middle prevent people from using S-Tunnel? What do you think about that, Alan?
Yeah, so RelayD is meant to be used in this man in the middle mode, say as like at a corporate firewall. And basically, it will show up as the SSL certificate for every website you go to. So, you know, if you're a client on the corporate network, when you try to go to Facebook, RelayD will go to Facebook, get the Facebook certificate, then generate its own certificate with the Facebook hostname and everything, but signed by the RelayD SSL key, and then present it to your browser. If your browser isn't configured, you're going to get the big scary warning saying this website is lying and it's not to be trusted, because that's what should happen. But if it's your RelayD or your company's RelayD, then you do trust it and you accept that certificate. So that doesn't stop anybody from making the SSL connections. It just lets them intercept the packets. So what the RelayD is doing there is decrypting it so it can tell what website you're going to, find out it's Facebook, and then block you instead. Or log it or whatever it wants to do. And the other thing RelayD was doing there was the perfect forward security, upgrading the encryption to be stronger when it's going to the outside world. So if someone was using a RelayD and you were trying to S-Tunnel, it wouldn't stop you from doing it. But if you were just doing the S-Tunnel, the person running the RelayD, if you accepted the forged certificate, would be able to read all of your decrypted traffic. But when you're doing SSH over S-Tunnel, they would get is the regular encrypted SSH. So they would decrypt the SSL part, but they would still have the SSH encryption. But if you were just doing, you know, Telnet or something over S-Tunnel, or just any other protocol over S-Tunnel, then they would get the decrypted version.
Okay.
So yeah, S-Tunnel lets you wrap anything in SSL, and RelayD allows you to intercept anything over SSL if the client is willing to accept your fake certificate.
Sure.
I hope that kind of explains what the difference is.
Okay.
So excellent. I guess it would let you decrypt the traffic and figure out that it's SSL and then decide to not allow, or figure out that it's SSH and decide not to allow SSH connections out. Although hopefully any admin on the network would be like, oh, you're SSHing? That's allowed. Because you're obviously cool if you know how to SSH.
Right. Okay, well, next up, it looks like our last question is from Alexander. And he's asking about the history of BSD now. So he's a new listener, found the podcast on the FreeBSD forums. Very cool. Watched the first 3 episodes, really enjoyed what we're doing here. He wanted to ask us about the history of the show, how it got started, who was doing what before and during the show, and why did you start the podcast?
Well, I guess for starting the podcast, it was I was doing an episode of TechSnap and a bunch of people in the chat room. We were talking about something about FreeBSD. I think it was 9.2 release, or no, it was before that. maybe mm-hmm. I think it was the first release candidate of 9.2 or something. And, you know, a bunch of people were like, oh, you should do a BSD podcast. I'm like, previously when that had come up like a year ago, when I had left the Linux Action Show, they're like, you should do a BSD show. And I'm like, I don't think there's enough news to do a BSD show every single week. And then as I got more involved in the community, going to the conferences, joining the mailing list, I realized there's a lot of stuff happening.
It's a lot of news. We're just not publicizing it as well.
As we should be, right.
The problem, which is why this show should exist.
Yeah. And then, so then the excuse was that I didn't have enough time to do the show. You know, with TechSnap, I spend hours every week writing the show notes and stuff. And then luckily, TJ in the chat room with his big mouth volunteered to help write the show notes. And I was like, oh, well, in that case, maybe we'll take a look at it. And so I kind of chatted with TJ a bit more, and we started up a Google Doc and started putting ideas in it. And then all of a sudden it was 10 pages. And we're like, oh, maybe we're not going to run out of things to talk about. and so it kind of went from there. And then it was like, well, I don't want to just host it with the Chris Fisher from TechSnap, because he's kind of a Linux guy and he doesn't really know. And, and you know, I'd rather have somebody BSD. And then so I kind of looking around, and I asked Will Bachman from BSD Talk, but he has engagements every night and really doesn't have the time to do it. And so I was kind of asking around, and then Drew recommended I ask Chris Moore. And I was like, well, yeah, I thought of him earlier, but I was like, there's no way he's going to have time. But I asked him anyway, and he did.
Yeah, there you go. The email came in. I was like, okay. I'll give that a shot. Yeah. Why not?
And then I went through the craziness of figuring out how to actually record the show. You know, with TechSnap, I just call in over Skype and magic happens. But for this show, I have to do it all. You know, I got four monitors up here, and it's a little distracting doing it all.
Yeah, you got actual equipment has to be maintained and set up.
And technical issues that come out of nowhere and don't have, you know, it's like it wasn't there last week and it won't be there next week, but this week, you know, it's decided that I should talk over top of Chris all the time.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot more delay this week for some reason. Yeah, who knows?
And, you know, we had it on episode 3.
Was it 3?
Yeah, episode 3 had that problem, and then 4 didn't, and 5 didn't, and 6 didn't, and then all of a sudden, 7, they're like, yeah, let's bring the delay back. It's very confusing.
All right. But, you know, it's been a good experience, though. It seems to be working out, and we sure haven't run out of things to talk about yet. I mean, shoot, we go to one conference, and we got 3 months worth of material just in interviews alone.
And the talks that we saw that we'd like to talk about, too. Because, that was the other thing, is when we started looking at interviews, I'm like, you know, if we start doing it, we kind of have to have an interview every week. That's going to be hard. And then it's like, oh, we have enough interviews to last through the end of the year or something like that.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. So when I first read this question, I thought he was asking about the history of the FreeBSD project. We have an interview with one of the co-founder of the FreeBSD project that will be airing maybe next week. So that should help with some of the questions. And we asked a little bit about that in our interview earlier in the episode with Paul Hennekamp, because he was there since the beginning.
Well, very cool. Hope we answered your question there, Alexander. Yeah. So that's the wrap-up for all the questions from this last week. So as usual, all the tutorials are going to be posted online at bsdnow.tv after the show's done airing here. And if you want to send your own questions in, please feel free to do so at feedback@bsdnow.tv. We don't necessarily check YouTube comments, JB comments, Reddit, etc. So if you want us to see it, please send it to that email. We do try and monitor Twitter, though. So if you want to tweet at us, we'll try and find it from there as well.
And so also, if you have ideas for what tutorial you'd like to see, you know, it's hard for us to decide, you know, do people want more basic tutorials, more complicated tutorials, or what if they want a tutorial about? Well, if you have something you'd like to see a tutorial done on, or if you've done something recently and have most of the material for a tutorial and want to donate that to us, then you can send that in as well.
I'd like to definitely do like an install fest tutorial. Just this is how you get this BSD installed and just kind of walk through it. That would be a fun one, a good way to introduce people to the BSD ecosystem.
Yeah. You know, with my first experience installing OpenBSD in a very long time recently while trying to get it to boot in Beehive, I was like, oh, their installer is quite a bit different.
Sure.
And I think the NetBSD one has changed a lot since last time I used it in like 2008.
Yeah, and I don't even remember what Dragonflies look like. I got to take a look at that.
I've actually never installed Dragonflies, so I don't even know what it looks like.
There you go. There you go. So that would be informative for us as well. So that we'll put that on the list. Yep. And as usual, guys, go ahead and watch us live Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern or 1800 UTC, where you can watch the raw and edited video and see how we put the show together. It's kind of like watching sausage be made, though. Yeah. So, you know, if you're not into that, you know, wait for the recorded video.
Yeah, and the recorded video normally comes out Friday morning-ish, but that's like U.S. West Coast time. So, like, what's that, plus 8 hours to UTC?
Yeah, another 3 hours
from here. Yeah, so you'll... Yeah, there were some people looking for it Friday morning in Europe, and it's like, no.
Not quite
the guy
yet.
That does the editing is still asleep at that point.
Yep, yep.
But usually by about lunchtime East Coast here on Fridays, the episode is posted. And the odd time, if you get lucky, it's Thursday, but mostly look for it Friday mornings. And there's RSS feeds if you want to get it automatically. And we have MP3, AUG, low and high res video, everything you could want.
Think of the podcast in the iTunes store well.
So, yeah, by the way, if you are an iTunes user, since most of our viewers aren't, positive ratings for the show in iTunes make a big difference as far as how high up the list of shows and in the search results the show shows up. And since, you know, our very technical audience, a lot of times, you know, I think a third of our downloads are done with like Fetch or Wget compared to most people using a podcatcher or iTunes or something.
Sure.
And so feedback in iTunes is very nice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you guys for joining us this week. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thanks for tuning in.